From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the making of The People vs. Larry Flint, we talk with director Milos Forman about why he made the film after initially rejecting it and why he almost couldn't cast the leading actress he wanted, Courtney Love. Also, as we approach Christmas, we talk with Peter Gomes, the minister at Harvard University's Memorial Church and author of The Good Book, Reading the Bible with Mind and Heart. And rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about one of his favorite albums of the year, but one that took him 6 months to warm up to. It's the latest CD by Beck. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Authorities believe as many as 9 people were killed in an explosion today at a manufacturing plant in Houston. Several people are believed missing. Capella Tucker from member station KUHF reports.
Workers at the Wyman Gordon factory say that Christmas parties were planned for today, but all have been told to go home. Cy Fair Volunteer Fire Department Assistant Chief Eric Pitov says the explosion blew a 40 by 50 foot hole in the roof, and crews are now searching about a 100-yard area around the building.
And we're searching fields for anything, parts of the building, the unit, and bodies, anything.
Pitov says they believe the explosion originated in an accumulator which holds compressed air or gas. An employee says the workers inside at the time were new hires. For National Public Radio, I'm Capella Tucker in Houston.
Light snow continues falling on the Sierra Nevada mountains. The region around Lake Tahoe is already buried under 8 feet of it. Conditions are expected to dry out later. Travelers are stuck. Heavy snow is not unusual in the Sierra Nevadas, but this is extraordinary. Even local residents are having some difficulty coping. Interstate 80 has been reopened by highway officials, but traffic is backed up for miles in both directions. State officials are encouraging everyone to stay home. Leftist rebels in Lima, Peru, released hostages late last night. The rebels called their release their Christmas gesture. While 225 people were let go, 140 are still being detained. Reporter John Miller is watching developments in Lima.
The first hostages who were released, a group of 4, including 2 ex-ministers of the Peruvian government. One, the former labor minister, read a statement from the rebel leader in the residence. Then the rest of the hostages started to come out, 225 of them, trooping across a darkened garden into waiting buses, government buses. As they left, people in the crowd, mostly journalists, but some families as well, cheering, waving, and they were waving back, looking quite relieved to be out after 5 days.
The United States Embassy official says 7 Americans are among the newly released. All the American hostages are now believed to have been freed. President Clinton welcomed this news. He called on the rebels to release the rest of the detainees. The hostage drama began last Tuesday when gunmen took over the Japanese ambassador's residence, where hundreds of people were attending a holiday party. The rebels are demanding freedom for about 300 of their jailed comrades. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up more than 15 points at 6,499 in light trading. The Nasdaq has fallen more than 2 points to 1,286. This is NPR. U.S. Mideast peace envoy Dennis Ross is in Israel today trying to hammer out a final agreement on Israel's long-delayed troop withdrawal from the West Bank town of Hebron. NPR's Eric Weiner reports.
President Clinton personally dispatched Dennis Ross to the Middle East on a mission the American mediator says is meant to energize the peace process. Shuttling between Jerusalem and Gaza, Ross is holding marathon meetings with Palestinian and Israeli leaders, trying to conclude an agreement on Israel's troop withdrawal from the West Bank town of Hebron. Israel had agreed to withdraw its soldiers from Hebron months ago, but the new Israeli government wants to first make changes to the original agreement, changes that it says are needed to ensure the safety of the 450 Jewish settlers who live in Hebron, a city with a Palestinian population of more than 100,000. An Israeli official says that after 3 months of talks, an agreement could be reached within a matter of days. But in the past, negotiations have often hit last-minute snags. As one Palestinian official put it, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
Thousands of ValueJet ticket holders have been stranded in Dallas and Fort Myers, Florida. The canceled flights were supposed to be operated by Kiwi International Airlines, but a ValueJet spokeswoman says Kiwi didn't provide adequate staffing and reliable service. She says only one of 21 Kiwi-operated flights Friday and Saturday was on time. Six more were canceled. ValueJet says passengers whose flights were canceled will be given full refunds and free round-trip tickets on other ValueJet flights. The Commerce Department says Americans' personal income rose last month and Americans spent that money. The agency says incomes rose 0.5% in November and American spending also rose 0.5%. The Commerce Department says the report is slightly better than what many analysts were expecting. Consumer spending is closely watched as an indicator of future economic performance. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Milos Forman, directed the new film The People vs. Larry Flint, starring Woody Harrelson as the publisher of Hustler magazine. A couple of weeks ago on our archive show, we featured an interview in which Forman discussed growing up in Czechoslovakia, first under the Nazis, then under the communists. We invited him back to talk about his new movie. His other films include The Loves of a Blonde, Fireman's Ball, Hair, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Amadeus, and Ragtime. The People vs. Larry Flint follows Flint's rise from small-time strip joint owner to pornography mogul. It also follows Flint in and out of court as he uses the First Amendment to defend himself against obscenity charges. During one of his obscenity trials, he was shot outside the courthouse, leaving him paralyzed from the waist down. In this scene, he's about to board a plane in defiance of a court order not to leave Los Angeles. His lawyer, played by Edward Norton, is fed up with Flint's courtroom antics and his continued defiance of judges.
Larry! Hey! Larry! Hey! Larry, you're not getting on that plane.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not. Don't do it. Do you think this is some kind of a game we're playing?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's a f***ing joke. 5.5 years since they shot me and the government...
Hey, I was there too, all right? You remember? You don't see me running around pissing off everybody we're trying to get to help us.
Yeah, well, you can walk and you can f***, and I'm in this chair. And I got money, okay? I got money and that gives me the power to shake up this system, Dougie.
Well, find somebody else to help you then. Because this is not what I signed on for. I don't even know what we're engaged in anymore, Larry. If you get on that plane, I quit.
Alan, don't be so melodramatic. You don't want to quit me. I'm your dream client. I'm the most fun, I'm rich, and I'm always in trouble.
Director Milos Forman says he didn't even read the screenplay for The People vs. Larry Flint when it was first given to him. He assumed it was an exploitation film about a sleazy character. But when he learned Oliver Stone was one of the producers, he read the screenplay and changed his mind about it. I asked what surprised him about the screenplay.
Surprised to discover that there is much more to a person who is known on only under one label. You know, it's... That's the danger, you know. It's we put a label based on our judgment about what this person is doing, like Larry Flint in this case is publishing Hustler, which I must say I never bought in my life. But I saw a few issues, you know, on the coffee tables here and there. And, you know, somehow we put that label, that sleaze, out of the tastelessness to the whole person. And then suddenly you are surprised when you discover that that person has much more to it than just this one side, that he has much more sides which are, to my surprise, rather admirable.
You've said that one of the reasons why you were interested in the movie is because you're interested in freedom of expression, and you lived under two totalitarian regimes growing up in Czechoslovakia, first the Nazis and then the communists. And I'm wondering if some of Larry Flint's uses of the right to free speech seemed trivial to you, both the pornography and things like nude photographs of Jackie Onassis. Having been deprived of free speech, did this seem like such a trivial way of taking advantage of it?
Yes, there is a lot of trivial things in what Larry Flint is doing, and there is a lot of, you know, tasteless things in which what he's doing. But, you know, freedom of the speech is much bigger than Larry Flint himself. And if he will serve for me to make a movie which will somehow eloquently, you know, say it's, you know, what I want to say about how important is the freedom of the speech, then why not to do it? You know, it's a, this country really never experienced censorship. And so we are taking the freedom for granted, and we don't know what kind of terrible consequences the loss of freedom of speech can have. Because, it might ruffle some feathers when I say, yes, we have to strive for 100% freedom of the speech. Because once you open the door to censorship, it never stops with pornography. It never stops with smut. It starts to spread. Who is going to decide what is obscene and who is not obscene? What is not obscene?
Was there pornography when you were growing up in Czechoslovakia?
No, there was not pornography. You know, that's the funny thing. You know, it's probably for this, moralists who are calling for censorship, the totalitarian regime would be ideal. Because for 40 years, you wouldn't see any pornography on Czech television or in Czech movies or on the magazines racks. You wouldn't see any, violence, anything like that. Everything was... And the good question is, do you think that any kind of a bad things which we try to blame, our moral relaxation for, that they didn't exist in those times? Oh, my God. They were as rampant as always before and always after, The basic difference between the totalitarian philosophies about art and our philosophy about art is that communists and all the totalitarian regimes, they want art to portray life as it should be. While, in the history of great art, art is supposed to portray the life as it is. And that's the basic difference. And believe me, there is nothing more boring than the endlessly seeing some, moralistic tales, either in the print or on the television or in the film, which is showing you some role models and the life as we should live it.
Miloš Forman is my guest, and he directed the new movie, The People versus Larry Flint. Now, let's talk a little bit about the casting for the film. Let's start with Woody Harrelson, who plays Larry Flint. How did you decide to use him in that role?
Well, I had the part of Larry Flint was the only part where in my contract I was obliged to have an agreement, mutual agreement with the Columbia Pictures. So I asked them to give me names of actors who would be acceptable to them. They gave me a list of about five names. Woody Harrelson was on it, but I didn't know Woody. I never saw him on television, and I saw him only in one movie before, which was not, his performance was not very memorable. And but now I must say thanks God that the first two actors who were offered the part turned it down, and then I asked to meet with Woody Harrelson. And I must tell you, from the first evening I met with Woody, I was sold on him entirely, because he is for me the actor of the highest order.
Can I ask who the two people were that turned the role down?
Yes, you can. Tom Hanks and Bill Murray.
Those are interesting choices. First of all, Tom Hanks is so kind of clean cut in his image. It's hard to imagine him as Larry Flint. Bill Murray, I think, could have been very interesting. He's a really fine actor. I'm not saying Tom Hanks wouldn't be interesting. It just seems like such an odd match.
Oh, they would be both great in very different way.
Mm-hmm, right.
But today I can't imagine anybody else but Woody.
Now, Courtney Love plays Althea, who was Larry Flynt's lover and then wife, and helped run Hustler magazine while she was alive. She died of AIDS. Courtney Love is in that role, and she was married to Kurt Cobain, the rock star who committed suicide, and she's the leader of the rock group Hole. Courtney Love, I think, has had her own problems, her own drug history. Was it difficult for you to, or difficult for her, to work with, you know, a character who has a drug problem, knowing that she had one herself?
Well, it was a problem not for me. It was a problem for the studio. Studio was adamantly against casting Courtney Love. And I don't want a conflict before even I start shooting, conflict with the studio, right? So I said, well, okay, who else? And so I was doing screen tests with other people, and Courtney was still, for me, the very, very best. But they were still adamantly against her because, as I was told, nobody would insure her. And that's very serious, because if you can't insure the main protagonist of the film, you are really at the mercy of... it's impossible. That's really serious, because if something happens, then it costs so much money and everything could collapse. So we found the insurance company. And I talked to Courtney. I told her, Courtney, you know, I will fight for you if you give me your word that you will not betray me. You know, it has nothing to do with how much I love you. Even if you betray me, I will still love you very much. But I can't offer you the part. And she gave me her word in such a way that I trusted her. And I said, okay, so here we have an insurance company. I got Courtney's word. Let's go. Studio still was not happy and told me that they will not pay the money for the insurance, and it was not a little money. It was $500,000, unrefundable $500,000. Well, you know, that only shows how she impressed everybody around her. Woody Harrelson, Oliver Stone, Michael Houseman, the producer, Courtney herself, and me, we paid for her insurance from our own pockets.
Really?
And one of the conditions was, for example, every week there was a person from insurance company all the time on the set watching, so that, you know, if something happens, that they know, because they obviously assumed that we would lie and, you know, cheat them or something. This is ridiculous. Also, she had to give a test, a urine test every week, you know. She was absolutely perfect. She was so honorable.
It's a great performance she gives. Did you give her any advice on how to act since she's not a trained actress?
You don't give advices, you know. You have to just, because, first of all, the talent, enormous talent is there, so you don't work on that. Then there was enormous kind of professional responsibility. She did a research which was mind-boggling, more than I ever, experienced with anybody I ever worked in films. And then, you know, just we had to be a little more patient the first few days, where she has to learn a certain, technical things about the camera, about the way films are shot and done and like that. And she learned very, very quickly, and that's, you know, at the end of the shooting, you know, she had the respect of even the most, you know, hard-nosed professionals in the crew. She was really amazing, amazing. And she also brought, you know, I realized one thing which was wonderful. That's probably from her experience on the stage, that every time she stepped in front of the camera, she was giving 100%. And that's from the stage. That's from the concert stage, where she, you know, you can't fake it. You don't have a second take when you go on the stage, right? So every time she stepped in front of the camera, she was giving 100%, and that was very, very inspiring for everybody, also for all the other actors and all for the crew people.
Ed Norton plays the part of Larry Flint's lawyer, Alan Isaacman. He's very good in the role. Tell me how you chose him.
He was my first choice from the first meeting. He was just right, the best for the part. And, you know, the funny thing is that later I learned, you know, he's arguing in the film the Larry Flint's cause in front of the Supreme Court, you know. His father, Edward's father, is a lawyer who argued in front of the Supreme Court. So that's sort of a funny trivia. But Edward was very important for me because he is the man whom I can identify. He is my ambassador, you know, the normal people's ambassador in the world of weirdness. And his whole personality suits so well. I really trust him. I really believe him. And he is capable of such a convincing performance on the screen that that's so important, you know, because he is expressing my feelings, my views about what's happening in that world of Larry Flint.
Now, you have Larry Flint playing a judge in Cincinnati who sentences Larry Flint to 25 years in an obscenity case. Did Larry Flint ask to play that part?
No. I was just joking one day, and I had a kick to say, you know, Larry, do you want to sentence yourself to 25 years in prison? And he laughed and said, oh, why not? So he's there, and we all had it. You know, it brought some kind of a wonderful feeling and atmosphere on the set because, you know, everybody had a kick out of it.
My guest is director Milos Forman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Milos Forman. He directed the new movie, The People versus Larry Flint. Something I read that you said about pornography, you've said that pornography, that you were brought up in an environment where pornography was considered bad, and you've never shaken that attitude about pornography. And you also feel especially uncomfortable if someone sees you while you're looking at pornography. And I'd like you to explain why.
Well, it has something to do with my upbringing, I guess, you know, because I was born in a small town. My parents, my father was a teacher, my mother was a housewife, but very active in socials, you know, circles in the town. And that, I don't know, I was going to church. And all this made me feel like the sex is bad, except in marriage, you know, that it's something I should be ashamed of even to think about, you know. And that just stays with you. It stays with me forever, I guess. You know, when I was, I never bought Hustler. I bought Playboy maybe, once I bought Playboy when the Jimmy Carter's interview was in the Playboy, and I was blushing when I was buying it at the corner of 57th Street and 6th Avenue, and I had a feeling that everybody is looking at me, and everybody is looking at me, you know, with such a disdain, and so I was like running home.
You could tell me if this is too personal, okay? You grew up during World War II. Your parents were both killed in concentration camps in Czechoslovakia. So you were on your own by the time you were 8, I think. How did you learn about the facts of life without a family?
Well, I lived with other families afterwards, and they were as good people as my family probably was, and how do you learn about these things? It's so ridiculous to think today that, you know, we have to just hide everything from our children and then they will be a wonderful citizens, you know. I remember that for us, when I was already 6 years old, I discovered a medical book, you know, in my father's library. And every time I was home alone, I was browsing, you know, through this book, watching this, you know, drawings of human body without clothes. You know, it's... That's how you discover things. You know, also, to believe that films or television, that they are so powerful, that you are educating so beautifully your children for 15, 20 years, and then that poor son of mine sees one movie or one television show and all this, my education goes down the drain. It's ridiculous, you know.
Did The People versus Larry Flint get an R rating?
Yes.
Did you have to do any negotiating with the film board in order to get the R as opposed to an X? Did they ask you to make any changes or to take anything out?
No. But it was my decision from the very beginning that I don't want this film to be rated more than R.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it's more important that, you know, a lot of young people can see this film than to shock somebody with some, you know... graphic shots of sex or violence or whatever.
Now, as a film director, how do you feel about the rating system?
I think it's good. I think the only censorship should exist in the family. Yes, the parents, they are responsible. They must be responsible fully for the education of their children. If they deem something which is improper for their children until they are adults, you know, yes, they should have a chance. And so the rating system helps them. And I think it works. It works, you know. The danger is that, the decision what the children or people can see or hear will be done by some government agency or some community board of censors. You know, that's the danger.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. Always a pleasure.
Milos Forman directed the new movie, The People versus Larry Flint. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk about Christmas, interpreting the Bible, and being an African-American gay minister with Peter Gomes, minister in Harvard University's Memorial Church. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews one of his favorite CDs of the year by Beck. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Peter Gomes is getting ready for Christmas, but he took some time to talk with us about his work as minister at Harvard University's Memorial Church. He's been there over 25 years. He's also a professor of Christian morals at Harvard. Now he's written a new book called The Good Book, Reading the Bible with Mind and Heart. In several chapters, he writes about how the Bible has been misinterpreted to justify racism, slavery, and homophobia. Gomes is African-American, and his students were stunned to learn a few years ago he is gay. In 1991, he came out at a rally in Harvard Yard, which protested an article in a conservative student magazine. The article attacked homosexuals, arguing that homosexuality was anti-Christian and bad for the individual and society. I asked Peter Gomes why he decided to speak out.
I felt that the Christian position and the Bible's position had been badly mangled and badly misinterpreted, and that the moral position had been used as in a way like a club or a stick with which to beat a particularly partisan point of view. And so I spoke not so much as an outraged homosexual, but as an outraged Christian and biblical teacher. That was what promoted me to speak as I did.
One of the quotes in the Bible that people often use to rail against homosexuality comes from Leviticus, and it says, "You shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination." So a lot of people say, well, the Bible says homosexuality is an abomination. What's your reading of that?
Oh, my reading is quite different from that. Of course, the Bible says that the Bible says an awful lot of things. Just because it's in the Bible doesn't necessarily mean it's true or it's normative or it's applicable. One has to use one's mind in reading the Bible. One realizes that that particular verse from Leviticus occurs in a whole context of what we call ritual purity laws, referring to the social context of Israelites invading the land of Canaan, trying to distinguish themselves from the people in whose land they were waging war, and whose principal objective was to produce as many new Israelis as they possibly could. Thus, any form of non-procreative sex was an abomination, that is to say, irregular, unusual. They felt the same way about masturbation. They felt the same way about coitus interruptus. They felt the same way about any kind of sexual relationship that did not advance the population of a beleaguered people. Their social anxieties and their social problems 7,000 or 8,000 years ago are not quite the same ones that we face today. We have to use our head in reading these texts, and to use that one verse as if that was equivalent to either the teachings of Jesus or the Ten Commandments or a whole discourse on sexuality really is a rather selective and in many respects a rather silly way of reading Scripture.
In your new book, you write that one of the great paradoxes of race in America is the fact that the religion of the oppressor, Christianity, became the religion of the oppressed and the means of their liberation. What's your understanding of how Christianity came to be both the religion of the oppressor and a tool for liberation of the oppressed?
It's one of the great paradoxes, I think, of Christianity, because if one acknowledges the reality of, say, black Christians in America, the inheritance of Christianity is a very mixed one. I think we all realize that Christianity was introduced to black people in this country as a form of social controls, a form of sort of cultural chloroform to keep folks quiet and calm and docile. And hence the white Christians who were responsible for this form of Christian activity, while they may well have been genuinely interested in the souls of their black folks, they were chiefly interested in controlling their minds and their bodies. So when a member of the Nation of Islam today asks a black Christian, how can you possibly affirm the slave master's faith even today, the paradox becomes very clear and very apparent. The paradox is that the very thing which was designed to repress and inhibit became the means first of sustenance and then the means of ultimate liberation and empowerment, which leads me to proclaim as loudly as I can that the truth of Christianity ultimately transcends those who themselves would preach it or practice it or teach it or subvert it. It is not a collection of individual opinions or practices, but a transforming, transcending, a living relationship with God that cannot be ultimately inhibited or destroyed. And the proof of that is that the very power that was used, intended for harm, ultimately and continues to be a power that has been used for great and enormous good. That has to indicate to me that Christianity succeeds in spite of Christians, not because of them.
I wonder how you feel about African-American students at Harvard who are or who have recently become Muslims. Do you almost take that personally as a rejection of Christianity?
Oh, no. Oh, my goodness, no. First, there aren't that many who do. But secondly, no. I mean, I think all of us have our spiritual journeys and our pilgrimages. And if for some students, some African-American students, the relationship between themselves and the infinite is best expressed by adopting some form of Islam, more power to them. I think that's fine. My point is that that is no more authentic in an absolute sense than being a Christian. These are all attempts on our part to explain ourselves and connect ourselves to something that is larger and grander than we are. There is no inherent reason for black people to be Muslims any more than Christians, for that matter. So no, I certainly don't take it as any personal affront at all.
My guest is Peter Gomes. He's the minister at Harvard's Memorial Church and professor of Christian morals at Harvard and author of the new book, The Good Book, Reading the Bible with Mind and Heart. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Gomes, minister at Harvard's Memorial Church and professor of Christian morals at Harvard and author of the new book, The Good Book, Reading the Bible with Mind and Heart. Now, I know one of your grandfathers was a Baptist preacher. Your mother played
yes.
organ and directed the church choir at a Baptist church in, was it Plymouth
in
where
Plymouth.
You grew up? Yeah.
Yes, and, where I was brought up.
And so she directed the choir at a predominantly white church in Plymouth, but on Sundays you went to the African American church. What was the difference between the two churches?
Oh, we were bilingual, as it were, doubly cultured. In the morning, in the town of Plymouth, you have to realize when I was growing up, population of about 12,000 people, and there may have been 50 black families, fewer than 100 black folk throughout that population, all of whom had been there a very long time, and to all intents and purposes, were black Yankees. And so in the morning, they went to the various white churches in town where they had always gone. Some were Episcopalian, some were Unitarian, some were Baptist, as my family was. Others were Methodists. But in the evening, we all supported the only cultural institution that was uniquely ours, a little African Methodist Episcopal church that had been founded just before the Civil War by some of the older black families. And so in the evening, we all went to the Bethel Church and sort of kept that going as our sort of community center. But the reason I think most of us were enrolled in the white churches in the morning was that they all had good Sunday schools, and lots of kids, lots of our friends were there. Our white friends were in those schools. And there weren't enough of us children to sort of keep a black Sunday school going. So our parents, I think, were very pragmatic. We'll keep the community going in the evening. We'll educate our kids in the morning, and we'll have the best of both worlds, which I certainly did.
As a minister at Harvard and a professor of Christian morals, you deal with morals with a lot of students in their late teens and early 20s. I think students are very interesting when it comes to morality because, on the one hand, many students are very idealistic and committed to living out their morals, and at the same time, they're often rebelling against conventional middle-class morality. And it's often a very extreme period for people. It's the one time in your life when it's most easy to live out the extremes of faith and the mm-hmm. extremes of mm-hmm. rebellion. So I'm wondering some of the things you try to do to guide students during that really volatile period.
Well, you've described it with great insight and accuracy, because that is exactly the case. Students bring to the institution a very intense set of moral ideals and a willingness to try to experiment with those moral ideals institutionally, while at the same time, privately or individually, they have not yet formed a kind of code of conduct or a set of standards by which they're willing to commit themselves forever and a day. So you have, in the 70s, for example, the remarkable phenomena where undergraduates were demanding that institutions function morally, for example, in the issues of divestment or in the issues of how land-holding universities dealt with the inner cities and so on, while on the one hand wanting institutional morality, but on the other hand insisting on sort of personal and private autonomy, don't mess with my values, that sort of thing. Well, nowadays, in the 90s, it's a rather different scene. And I think because of the general collapse of a moral consensus in the country, in the culture over the last decade or so, I think we have more and more students sort of groping as to what is a proper personal code of conduct. How does one relate to the varieties of people that they encounter? The feminist movement created a whole new set of gray areas in how the sexes relate and how one carries on both public and private relations with people with whom one is not necessarily familiar, given the background our students may come from. So this has created a whole new, I think, yearning, if you will, on the part of the young for some guidance, and guidance which they ask for at very many levels of undergraduate life. Hate speech, for example. Where does the line between free speech and abusive speech begin and end? What is the proper relationship between men and women and between men and men and women and women? How does one deal with the freedom to drink and smoke on the one hand, that sort of private preserved rights, and the legal and the social and the moral questions that are involved when those activities impact upon the larger community?
I don't want to force you into generalizations, but do you see any patterns? Have you seen any patterns over the years about whether more students were turning from or turning to religion?
Well, I like generalizations. That's what I do for my life's work. But and on this particular subject, I can generalize ad infinitum. The short answer is yes. I've seen the generations now since 1970, almost without exception, moving perceptively more and more into an attitude of discovery about the religious dimension of their lives. In the 70s, many people had sublimated whatever religious ambitions they had or interests they had had to more active kinds of activities. And social justice became a religion. Personal autonomy became a religion. the anti-war movement, feminism, these became religions, environmentalism, the peace movement, these all became religions of sort. These have all had their day and been transmuted and transformed in some sense or another, leaving only religion left to be considered as a religious phenomena. And I think that my observation has been that students over these years have discovered more and more the need for a centered self, as we call it, the need for and a personal authenticity as opposed to mere personal autonomy. And when that begins, when that inquiry begins, it almost invariably, inevitably leads to asking the deep questions of life, the great meaning questions. I'm always annoyed at Monty Python for having destroyed the credibility of the question, the meaning of life, but that is what kids are into at this point. And that has been, I think, an ever-increasing enterprise since the mid-1970s.
This will be your 26th,
27th? 27th, entering my 27th year.
27th Christmas at Harvard?
Yes.
What's Christmas like for you at Harvard?
Well, it's very funny. It's unlike it is in other places. In quote, real churches, people come home to Christmas, and it's a big deal. In the universities, you can imagine, people go home. And so Cambridge is depleted. It's empty, even as I speak now, of students. The lights are all out, and it has a strange, eerie quiet to it. But we have services on Christmas Eve, which have evolved over the years into rather pleasant, intimate family gatherings, because faculty and staff, of course, are still here. And their children often come home to Cambridge from wherever it is that they are during the year. So we have, in many respects, the same kind of lively congregation, but it's composed of a slightly different people with a slightly different feel at this time of the year.
Do you have a favorite Christmas or a favorite Christmas memory?
Well, again, they begin to blur in a way, but I have a sort of pastiche of Christmas's past, which form a pattern for me. I can remember, and these elements are so evocative, they say the last thing to go is the sense of smell, and the smell of balsam pine trees on Christmas Eve when we went out to get our tree when I was a child still drives me back to being 8 or 10 years old. We went out not on Christmas Eve to get a tree, not because it was a romantic kind of thing to do, but because they were cheaper on Christmas Eve. And my father was a very sensible man and knew that about 8 o'clock on Christmas Eve, the tree lots were most eager to get rid of whatever they had left, and we always did very well by that. But I can to this day recall the sense of setting that tree up in our house in Plymouth and the smell of those branches. And whenever I smell that tree today, my youth comes back. I also remember going to the midnight service with an old friend of our family every year at Christmas Eve at the Episcopal Church. It was a small but lovely old late Victorian Gothic place. And the music was lovely, and it was lit by candlelight, and there was the slight hint of incense. It was a wonderful combination, the smell of incense and old money. It was a great kind of evocative experience. And even after all these years, if I had a choice of a place to be on Christmas Eve saying my prayers, it would be at Christ Church in Plymouth. So there are things like that. And the continuity of one's family is very important. And I've watched my godchildren, my cousin's children, who are now in their mid-30s, they've kept every Christmas of their life with me and my late parents. To be with them and see them, the lovely adults that they are, and to recall all of the years of their growing up, that's a very powerful connection for me. And it all sort of blurs and melds all together into one kind of evocation.
Do you have favorite parts of the Bible to read at Christmas time?
Well, of course, the parts I most enjoy reading at Christmas time are the Luke's Christmas narrative and Matthew's Christmas narrative as well. But I think Luke's is just so economical and lovely. And I always read it in the King James Version. There's just no other way to hear the Christmas story than in those 17th century cadences. I don't want it made crisp and clear. I want it to float and have all those wonderful angles that I remember from hearing that lesson as a child. So I read that lesson from Luke's Gospel with that wonderful beginning. There went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed, and so on and so forth, all the way through to the departure of the angels into heaven and the shepherds returning back to their fields, leaving Mary to ponder all these things in her heart. It's an absolutely gorgeous piece of prose, perhaps my favorite in all of Scripture.
Well, Peter Gomes, I wish you a Merry Christmas, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. Same to you.
Peter Gomes is minister at Harvard University's Memorial Church and author of The Good Book, Reading the Bible with Mind and Heart. Here's a song from Rosemary Clooney's new Christmas album.
I'm dreaming tonight of a place I know even more than I usually do. And although I know it's a long road back, I promise you I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me. Please have snow and mistletoe and presents on the tree. Christmas Eve will find me where the love light gleams. I'll be home for Christmas if only in my dreams.
Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews a CD he thinks is one of the best of the year. This is Fresh Air. This year, the 25-year-old singer-songwriter Beck released his second major-label album called Odelay. Beck came to prominence 3 years ago for his playful slacker anthem, Loser. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's taken a while, but the charms of Odelay have grown on him. Here's a review.
You only got one. Taken for granted what the Lord's laid on the floor. So I'm picking up the pieces and I'm putting them up for sale.
I like to think that Beck would appreciate the fact that it's taken me about 6 months to really get into his intentionally tattered, pasted-together music that forms Odelay. After all, Beck likes to make sneaky music that slowly snakes its way into your brain, stuff that requires repeated listening to figure out. During any given song on Odelay, you think, is that his voice or a snippet of someone else's? Is that Beck's fractured melody or an electronic sample he's chopped up and rearranged in the manner of a latter-day Dada artist? This is a guy, after all, who calls one of the songs here ready-made, after Marcel Duchamp's term for some of his found art.
An open road where I can't breathe, where the lowest low is calling to me. I can pull myself back up, back down, stuck together like a ready-made. And nobody knows where we've been. Canceled rations are running thin. Watches tick, out of tune, falling apart like a ready-made. And my bags are waiting.
The first few times I listened to Odelay, I found its raggediness disconcerting. Beck's apparent lack of interest in conventional song forms, his cheerful refusal to make his own voice a distinctive trademark, was disorienting. What was this kid up to? But I started playing a tape of Odelay in the car, where the distractions of the road suited the fragmented nature of the music. It kind of helped me go with Beck's flow. It also helped that I began to notice that quite often Beck was making lovely music.
So long, your blind eyes are gone, your old bones are on their own. So take off your coat, put a song in your throat, let the dead beats pound all around. We will go nowhere we know. We don't have to talk at all. Hand-me-downs, fly paper towns, stuck together, one and all.
For Beck, folk and hip-hop reside on the same level. It's unbelievably refreshing to hear a white musician who's not using hip-hop technique as either novelty or exotic effect. And it's heartening to hear a hip-hop fan who realizes you don't have to reject folk's simple directness to achieve your own complications. As Odelay proceeds, all of Beck's distorted vocals, skewed melodies, and layered instrumentation coheres as the sound of a young man roaming the sonic frontier, picking up this bit of junk, that forgotten treasure, stopping to smell this rose and prick his thumb on that thorn. Odelay has ended up being one of my favorite albums of the year.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Beck's new album, Odelay. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Tracy Tannenbaum and Lawrence Donahue Green. Alan Too directed the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
It takes a backwash man to sing a backwash song, like a frying pan when the fire's gone. Driving my pig while the band's taking pictures in the grass. And my radio smashed, and I like pianos in the evening sun. Dragging my heels till my day is done. Saturday night in the captain's clothes. Tin horns blowing when my jewelry froze.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Barbara Lee sings Cole Porter. It's the first in our week-long series, Words and Music, featuring tributes to songwriters and songwriters performing their own songs. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.